walks past galleries and restaurants and antique shops, an ice cream parlor, a jewelry store. Tenny Gulliver's house was on Pine Street, just off Main. It was an ancient among the elderly. The plaque on the front of the house said it had been built in 1704. The house stooped and sagged. The shingles were mildewed, and the white paint of the trim was flaking away. Delilah dropped the big brass knocker and waited a long time, long enough that she began to wonder if the unthinkable had happened to Tenny Gulliver between the time she had hung up the phone and now. But finally there was the sound of the lock being undone, and the door swung open, and there was Tenny Gulliver, all 85 pounds of her, with her white, cottony hair and her shrunken apple face and her cane. Tenny Gulliver looked exactly as Delilah had expected, a bit of a disappointment, since Delilah loved to be taken by surprise, like the old woman who lived in a shoe. It was as though Delilah had not only traveled 1,200 miles across the country, but also 120 years back in time. Tenny Gulliver lit her main room with candles and the kitchen with a dim overhead bulb. "I need proper light when I'm cooking," Tenny said. There was radio, but no TV. A rotary phone, but no answering machine. A gas stove, but no microwave. Delilah's room would be upstairs. There were, in fact, 5 bedrooms upstairs, and Delilah could have any one of them, Tenny said. Tenny's bedroom was on the first floor. It was the den, converted, because Tenny could no longer negotiate the stairs. "Okay," Delilah said. She liked the idea of having her choice of 5 bedrooms, of inhabiting all 5 on successive nights, like a girl who lived in a castle. Actually, there was something about being here on Nantucket on her own, in this old, old house with this old, old woman, that made Delilah feel not like an adult, but like a child. As if reading her mind, Tenny said, "How old are you?" Delilah lied. 19. Tenny said, "Do you need a job?" Delilah paused, thinking about her 885 remaining dollars. Despite her free rent, she would have to work. She had not thought about any particular job beyond her job of living deliberately, but she would have to make money deliberately. She said, "I babysit." Tenny stared. Could she hear? Her ears were like small white shells, but they were unencumbered by the beige hearing aids that Delilah's grandparents wore. Delilah said, "Do you have grandchildren?" Tenny said, "Vern's last name is Snow. He's the son I had with my first husband. The son I had with my second husband, Mr. Gulliver, Gully, lives in Sconset. He chops firewood for a living and should be avoided." Delilah nodded. Everybody had 1,000 stories. "I'm going to heat up a lobster pie. You'll eat?" "Yes," Delilah said. "Thank you." She lugged her backpack up the steep, narrow staircase. The 5 bedrooms upstairs were prim, spare, spinsterish, as appealing as 5 bedrooms in a convent or a nursing home. They were much alike, but Delilah claimed the only one with a double bed. The bed was about 5 feet off the ground. It was a bed for a giant. Delilah would need to stand on a chair just to climb up on top of its white chenille spread and lay her head on the stiff pillows. There was a nightstand with a dainty lamp made of milk glass wearing a fringed shade that looked like an old lady's church hat. There was a bureau that had 27 drawers, and next to the bureau was a dressing table that supported a triptych mirror, open like a book. Delilah sat at the dressing table and looked at herself in the triptych mirror. She looked at herself deliberately. She was safe here. Delilah woke up the next morning in a fresh mood. It was the first day of her new life. She could do whatever she wanted. So this, she thought, was freedom. What did she want to do? What did she want to do, really? Go for a walk? Spend money on a restaurant breakfast? Lie in bed for an hour and read Cheever? She descended the stairs to find Tenny making buttermilk biscuits and bacon and brewing some wicked-smelling coffee. Tenny said, "You'll eat?" Delilah breathed in, breathed out. It was amazing the obligation she felt, even to this woman whom she'd known only half a day. Did she want to eat breakfast with Tenny? She meant to stick to her guns, hold sacred her duty to herself. The bacon was crisp, the biscuits looked fluffy, and Tenny set out a pot of softened butter. There was cream for the coffee, real cream. Delilah's mother bought only fat-free lightener, and hence Delilah had never learned to like coffee. And Delilah's mother never cooked bacon. Full of nitrites, she said. Yes, Delilah said. From now on, Delilah's life would include bacon and coffee with real cream and 2 teaspoons of sugar. And Delilah would get the biscuit recipe.
You'll go see Vern about the job?
Tenny said. Delilah was confused. What job?
Where?
She said.
Lobster restaurant, Tenny said. In town. You can't miss it.
Delilah did not want to work in a restaurant. Dean Markbury waited tables at Denny's, plunking down Grand Slam breakfasts and club sandwiches for $2 an hour. He had to wear polyester pants. But what if Delilah had no choice? She pulled apart her biscuit. The flaky layers were like the pages of a book. She wanted to learn to cook. She wanted to meet the black sheep wood-cutting son, who in Delilah's mind looked exactly like the man on the bus, and get married. Or not. She would see. Nantucket Town on a mellow spring morning. No tourists to speak of. Shopkeepers sweeping geranium petals off the brick sidewalk. They smiled at Delilah and stared at her a few extra seconds trying to place her. Is that so-and-so's daughter? No, it's someone else. I don't know who that is. It was liberating to be a stranger. She found Vern's on her own. It was impossible to miss, at the base of Main Street. The sign in front said Vern's, and another sign said Lobster. Delilah wandered in. Well, it wasn't Denny's. There was a dark wood bar lined with tall stools, the seats of which were made from upside-down lobster pots. There were scarred wooden tables and hanging fishing nets and brass portholes fixed into the wall and green and red port and starboard lights. The door had been left wide open. A sweating glass of water and a bowl of lemons were on the bar. Delilah thought maybe the place was open for lunch, but it was empty. Hello? She called out. A muted TV was on over the bar. It was the midday news, and Delilah filled with dread. She did not want to think about the outside world, about Michigan or her weeping family. She watched the screen for a second. Bad house fire in a place called Dedham. There were hundreds of millions of people in this country. Delilah Ashby gone missing would not register beyond the limits of the South Haven School District, right? A man came out of the kitchen wearing brown rubber pants held up by suspenders.
Hi, he said. You're the girl living with Ma?
This was Vern. He had thinning blonde hair and a permanent sunburn and a thick New England accent. He said he would hire her, even though she had no experience, because she could stay the whole season, right? She wasn't going to leave him in the lurch in the middle of August like Little Miss Smarty Pants from Radcliffe, right?
Right,
Delilah said. He told her she could expect to make $100 in tips a night. The lobster dinner was $29.95 and included baked potato, corn on the cob, homemade coleslaw, and a dinner roll. Most people like to start with a bowl of chowder or a plate of steamers, and most people liked a glass of Chardonnay or an ice-cold beer, sometimes 2 or 3 of these, and then most people could not turn down the homemade pies, all in season. This week was lemon meringue, and hence the average bill was up there.
Come Friday at 3 and I'll train ya, Vern said. Bring your working papers.
Working papers? Delilah fretted. She stood up to leave. What would she do about working papers?
Before you go, Vern said.
He nodded her back to the kitchen, and a warning bell went off in Delilah's head. Was this where he tried to have his way with her? And if he did try to have his way with her, might he forgive the fact that she didn't have any working papers? She followed Vern into the kitchen. It was immaculate, shiny countertops, sparkling stainless steel. In the sink was a wire bucket of clams. Vern took a shell out and pried it open with a short, dull knife.
Cherry stones, he said. Went out this morning myself and got them.
Delilah peered at the snot-like globule attached to its home shell.
Uh-huh, she said. Go ahead, Vern said.
Go ahead what, she thought. Touch it? Take it home? She smiled, sort of.
Eat it, he said.
Eat it? She tried not to make a face. She breathed. If she ate this phlegmy-looking raw mollusk, would he forgive her the lack of working papers? She reached out two pincer fingers. He pried the clam loose with his knife. He was keen for her to taste it, not in a little boy, go ahead, I dare you way, but in an avuncular, professorial way. She held the shell. Was she really going to eat it? She was from the Midwest, where there weren't even any sushi restaurants. Delilah was pretty sure, however, that Thoreau would have eaten the clam. He would have sucked it down for his own edification. Delilah would do the same. At first it was foreign in her mouth, slippery, chewy. Then it burst with sweetness, sugar from salt water. She swallowed. Vern said, "Food doesn't get any fresher than that." Delilah headed back to Tenny's at 4 o'clock. She chewed on the concrete problem of working papers. It was a relief, actually, to have a concrete problem, rather than the abstract ones of whether she would be discovered and whether she was living deliberately or simply falling into another routine. She opened the door to Tenny's house. She had been given her own key, which she kept clipped to her belt loop, and she heard a man inside. Her heart tripped up a second as she thought of the black sheep's son, the woodcutter. She saw a man's head, black hair, visible even over the high-backed chair. A big man. Tenny said, "Well, hello," in a tone of voice Delilah had not heard her use before. A saved-for-company voice, or maybe an I'm-in-danger voice. Was Tenny being held captive? "Hi," Delilah said. She stepped into the living room. The man turned. It was her father. One evening, after a particularly difficult day, Delilah left the boys with Jeffrey and walked into town. She sat on the curb opposite Tenny Gulliver's house on Pine Street. Had that story really been true? Yes, every word, or approximately so, since that was what memory or memoir was, an approximation of the truth. Certain things were crystal clear. Eating the raw clam, seeing her father's face, but other things were hazy. Like what she and her father had said to each other on the way home, or how Nico had actually found her. When she'd asked him, he said, "I followed your breadcrumbs." Or what had made her give up her Thoreau dreams and do what was expected of her. Finish high school, attend the University of Michigan, graduate in 4 years, pack up her room, kiss her parents, and then at the age of 22 returned to Nantucket, where she was able to secure a job at Vern's as if no time had passed at all. And then she fell in love with the farmer who delivered Vern's corn on the cob and salad greens. She fell in love with Jeffrey Drake, even though he was not the black sheep woodcutter son, Gully, but rather a man just like her father. Predictable. Tenny Gulliver had been dead for years, and Vern had sold both Tenny's house and his restaurant, taken the money, and bought a place in Florida. Delilah pictured him now as an older man, eating Grand Slam breakfasts at Denny's. Was he happy? She fantasized about running away again. Her anger at Andrea Kappenash was a tumor in her lung that was keeping her from breathing properly. Her secret knowledge of Greg's continuing affair with April Peck was an ulcer in her gut. And the guilt of her silence on that final morning was meningitis, inflaming her brain. Her bones ached with regular old sad sadness. She felt strapped to this island like a crazy person to a bed. If she stayed, she was sure she would die. Delilah stood up from the curb. A family by the name of Hebner had bought Tenny Gulliver's house, and it looked a lot better now. The Hebners had jacked up the house and squared the foundation. They had replaced windows and painted the trim, and replaced the old door knocker with a brass clamshell. Still, it was Tenny's house, the very same house where Delilah had spent exactly one night the May she was 16. She had been so brave and so stupid. Delilah was older now by more than double. Her own life's circumstances had been squared and given a new coat of paint. But really, nothing had changed. Phoebe. They had sent out 750 invitations to the cocktail party that would celebrate Island Conservation's purchase of the 92-acre parcel in the Savannah, and they had 310 people RSVP to say they were coming. Phoebe and Addison had bought benefactor tickets at $1,000 apiece, but Phoebe had not heard from Jeffrey and Delilah or the chief and Andrea, her own friends. She had sent them invitations with her name as co-chair circled in red pen and festooned with stars as a kind of self-deprecating joke, but she hoped the message was clear. This was her thing, and they would be expected to come. Phoebe had a surprise plan to boot, which they could not miss. Attendance was mandatory at $150 a ticket. It wasn't the ticket price that was holding them back, Phoebe knew. Both couples could afford it. What was holding them back was their grief. Their retreat from everyday, normal, happy life. With the state Andrea and Delilah were in, they probably didn't even open their mail. Phoebe would have to call them. Before, when faced with an unpleasant task, she would take a Valium, 3, 4, 6, and operate in a fog. But now she considered her pills poison. She had thrown every last prescription bottle into a shoebox and tucked the shoebox away. She wasn't hiding it from herself. Now she was hiding it from Addison. The necessary evil of the phone calls. Delilah first, because with Delilah, things were slightly easier. Hello? Delilah said aggressively. This could be good or bad. My benefit? Phoebe said. The island conservation thing next Friday? You and Jeffrey are coming. No. Yes, you are. There is no excuse that will work with me. You have to be there. It's the first thing I've chaired in 100 years. I'm not going to anything this summer. This is the summer of no. This is the summer that wasn't. Well, that was true. In previous summers, the eight of them had been out all the time. At the celebrity softball game that benefited the kids' school, at the circus for the Athenaeum, at cocktail parties, at the back table at the Company of the Cauldron, at the back bar of 21 Federal, at the summer concert for the Boys and Girls Club, at the Boston Pops benefit for the hospital. This year, they had done exactly nothing. Understood, Phoebe said. Who was she to talk? She had been on a mental vacation for 8 years. But this you have to come to, this one thing, one night. Mark and Etney are catering. Mark said he'd make the gougères with the melty cheese in the middle for you especially, okay, darling?
Not okay.
Why not?
I won't be here.
Where will you be?
Silence. She was either bluffing or being dramatic. She never went away in the summer. Nantucket was Delilah's playground. Nobody enjoyed the island as much as Delilah. At 10 o'clock at night, you would find her at the turtle pond with her kids, dangling raw chicken from a string, waiting for the calm surface to break. Or grilling 3-inch ribeyes on her back deck, drizzling heirloom tomatoes with olive oil, jumping up and down if her croquet ball actually cleared the wicket. Or singing along as Greg sang Hey Girl at the Begonia.
Where are you going? Phoebe asked.
To hell in a handbasket.
Jesus, Delilah, you're coming to my event. That's all there is to it. Please? For me?
I can't.
I have a surprise for you. A big, happy surprise.
That's not going to work.
Sure it is. I'm going to RSVP you for 2 people. Get a babysitter, okay?
Silence.
Okay?
Okay. Phoebe could not bring herself to call Andrea. Some disturbing stories had reached Phoebe's ears. Andrea allowed the twins to roam town unsupervised, and she was acting out in other destructive ways. Phoebe could not call up with the frivolous business of a cocktail party, but Andrea and the chief had to be there, because of the surprise. And so Phoebe called the chief. The dispatcher, Molly, put her right through. "Hey, sunshine," the chief said.
"Hey, Eddie."
"What's up?" She told him. Cocktail party for island conservation, her first flight in 8 years. It was important to her that he and Andrea come. "Okay, then we'll come."
"You will?"
"Of course. I've been wanting to get out of the house. It will be good for Andrea, too. Real good." Phoebe agreed with this. But wait, she felt funny. This was too easy. Phoebe had questions. Had they gotten the invitation when she sent it? If they had gotten it, why had they not responded? Phoebe had the strange feeling that Andrea had opened the invitation and had thrown it away, or, in her current state of mind, soaked it in gasoline, stuck it in a bottle, and turned it into a Molotov cocktail. Ed normally ran everything past Andrea first. He was the police chief, but everyone knew who the real chief was. It wasn't like him to make plans for both of them like this, without even asking.
"And I have a surprise," Phoebe said, "at the party."
"Is it legal?" Phoebe laughed.
"Yes."
"Well, okay then. We'll see you next Friday, if not before." Phoebe hung up. Mission accomplished. She should be happy. But something felt weird, not quite right on either front. Or maybe what felt wrong was that there had been only 2 phone calls instead of 3. No call to Greg and Tess. She couldn't let herself follow this train of thought. It would do her in. She would become just like the rest of them, singing a song out of tune. She would not think about it. She went out to the pool. Addison. Floribel approached his desk with astonishing news. A couple named Legree Pouffet and Hank Drenmiller had made a full-price offer on the cottage in Quays. Floribel looked like she was about to burst open like a piñata, penny candy for everyone. Safe to say that Addison had never seen her this animated. Floribel was a lipstick lesbian, a stunning woman who despised everyone. She had managed the Wheeler Realty office for over a decade, but the first listing Addison had given Floribel to handle, with full commission, was the Quays Cottage, and this only recently, since Tess's death, since Addison could not bear to think about the cottage at all, much less deal with the business of selling it. The cottage was owned by an elderly couple from Princeton, New Jersey. The husband sat on the board of trustees at Lawrenceville, and this was how Addison had met him. The elderly couple had 3 cowboy children. They lived in places like Cody, Wyoming, and San Antonio, Texas, who had no interest in Nantucket and wanted their parents to sell the place. Sell it, yes, but the couple wanted $3 million, not a penny less, for a 400-square-foot summer cottage, and because of a 300-year-old Wampanoag cemetery that abutted the property, a covenant was in place, stating that the cottage could not be expanded. The cottage was essentially unsellable at that price with those restrictions. It had languished on the market for years. Addison eyed Floribel suspiciously. "These puffy Drenmillers know they can't add on, right? They can't tear it down and build something else. They can't touch it. They know this?"
"Yes,"
Floribel said. She had told him once that she had been a cheerleader in high school, and as improbable as this had seemed at the time, she was an utter bitch, prone to sniffing at people, granting only her favorites a malicious smile. He now caught a glimpse of her game day enthusiasm. "And they still offered $3 million?
"Yes,"
Floribel said. Her wide blue eyes were about to pop into bouquets of violets. She was genuinely happy. All it had taken was money, a 6% commission on $3 million. "Okay," Addison said. "Great. Good for you. Write it up." His voice was maudlin, He could not summon even a trace of perfunctory congratulation. He, Addison Wheeler, Wheeler dealer, who loved nothing more than fresh ink on a purchase and sale agreement, who had been known to throw his hat in the air when a financing contingency was waived, who had been known to treat the entire office to a 5-course lunch at the Walwinette when a major property closed, could not even fake a smile in response to the news that an unsellable property had sold. Floribel, thank God, could not have cared less about Addison's underwhelming response. She just wanted to be smug about her news with everyone in the office, and Addison was her first stop. He had given her the listing, but it had been something of a gag, a white elephant. Floribel had had beginner's luck. Well, either that, or she had true realtor skill, the ability to interface the right buyer with the right property. She moved on to Arthur Dimity's desk. Arthur could be counted on to scowl with undisguised envy, which Floribel would find gratifying. Addison should have given the listing to Arthur, he realized now. Addison would have a hard time with a lemonade stand in the desert. He handled only rentals. Addison wanted to run out of the office. But wait, he couldn't be too obvious. He counted to 10. The phone rang and no one answered it. It was Floribel's job, but she was too busy gloating. Addison should answer the phone, he knew, to show that answering the phone was not beneath him, and as a tiny concession to Floribel's good news. For all he knew, too, it could be the puffy Drenmillers calling to renege. But Addison was too upset to talk to anyone on the phone. He let the call go, so it would be picked up by the general voicemail box. Behind him, he heard Arthur's strained congratulations. Arthur said, "How did you meet these people, the Drenmillers?" And Floribel said, "Believe me, you don't want to know." "Okay," Arthur said amiably. And this was why he wasn't a great salesman. He never pressed the issue. But this time Addison agreed. Okay, who cared? Nobody. Not Arthur, not him. He was having a hard time holding steady. He had to get out of there. He surreptitiously unlocked his top drawer. Tess's iPhone was still there, hidden in the back of the drawer. He checked it every day, and every day it was cold and silent, though to him it hummed and glowed with radioactivity. Today, however, he was looking for keys, but the keys he wanted were not in his drawer. Of course not, Floribel had them. But then he found a different set of keys, and a thought came to him. Whoa. So many weeks since Tess had died, and he had not thought about the can of bug spray in her garage. Addison found he could speak to Tess when he was driving, because he was alone and moving forward, and the combination of these two things put him in a psychic state where he could communicate with the dead. "They're selling our cottage," he said. "It's sold. It will belong to someone else at the end of August." His heart was dust. His spirit was the frilled brown edge of a badly fried egg. He was desiccated and dry. His body was filled with crumbly sand. He and Tess had loved that cottage. Addison had told her that he would buy it. He would pay the $3 million. She could leave Greg and he would leave Phoebe, and they could live together in the cottage. Tess had laughed nervously. He was delusional. This wasn't real. It was a fantasy. No one could actually live in that cottage. She couldn't live there. What would she do with her kids? She had never seen it the way he saw it. She had never been willing to give it all up, to give any of it up. Their affair had been, what, to her? A way to spend a few hours? A safety net? A security blanket? Protection from the marital whiplash that Greg provided daily? They had fought about it. Addison did not like to admit to himself that they had fought, but they had fought. He loved her insanely. He looked at her across the room when they were all together, and couldn't believe she didn't belong to him. He had to endure watching her hold hands with Greg and kiss him and call him hun. Addison told Tess that seeing her touch Greg made him want to set himself on fire. She said she tried not to touch Greg when Addison was around, but sometimes she forgot or couldn't avoid it. This made Addison boil over with jealousy and resentment. She tried not to touch Greg when Addison was around. But what about when Addison wasn't around? Did they make love? Did she make love to Addison in the cottage and then go home and make love to Greg? She said no. She was offended by the suggestion. But Addison was suspicious. Greg had animal magnetism. Women threw themselves at him. How often do you make love to him? Addison asked her. Not very, she said. I want you to leave him, Addison said. I can't, she said. The kids. The kids were her zone of immunity. Whenever Addison pressed her, she brought up her kids. She could betray Greg. God knows he had betrayed her, but she could not betray her kids. She did not want her kids to have divorced parents. She did not want her kids to have a stepfather. And she, Tess, did not want a separation, a divorce lawyer, shared custody. She had left Greg for that one godforsaken week in November, and she had said all those words out loud. She had chewed them up and eventually spit them out. Addison pulled into Tess and Greg's driveway. He had shown their house only 3 times since it had gone on the market, all 3 times to visitors who did not know what had happened to the owners. No one had gone back to look a second time. Addison was thinking of lowering the asking price. Tess had her own key to the Quays cottage. Addison had not remembered this when he went through her house the first time weeks ago, but he remembered it now. He had asked her once where she kept the key. Tess was paranoid about getting caught. Where would be safe enough? And she had said, I keep it hidden under the bug spray in the garage. He found it there. On one of the many shelves for house and garden necessities was an orange-capped can of Raid, and underneath it lay the key. The day was sunny and dry after 3 days of showers, heavy fog, and thunderstorms. The pulpous road looked scrubbed and squeaky clean, like something that had just been removed from the box. The fields to the right side of the road were green and freshly cut. The view of the harbor to the left seemed polished. Did you ever really love me? He asked. Oh, God, she said. Of course I did, but... But what? It was complicated, wasn't it? She used to send him song lyrics, which he quasi-resented. It seemed so Greg-like. Her favorite line was from a U2 song. You say in love there are no rules. Tess liked to believe that her love for Addison was renegade, something beyond her control, something she could not be held accountable for, something that had happened to her, not that she had made happen. In this way, she was not responsible. Love had been visited on them from above at some point during their lunch together at Nuit de. Sandrine had done it. Sandrine was a witch. Addison pulled into the driveway of the Quays cottage. Was he going to cry? It didn't matter if he did. He cried all the time now. He had stopped feeling embarrassed by it. He had not been to the cottage since... Well, since the 17th of June, a Friday, Tess had met him while the twins were at camp. She had reminded him, on that day, of her impending anniversary. On that day, she had gently told him about the planned sale to the vineyard. Greg's idea, she said. Tell him no. I think that would be aggressive, she said. It would send up red flags. He's trying to win you back, Addison said. He can't win me back, Tess said. I'm yours. So then why are you going? Addison asked. And Tess said, please don't make this any harder than it already is. Meet me here on Sunday afternoon, please, one last time before you go sailing. Addison went to the cottage every Sunday to change the sheets and do some basic housekeeping.
You know Sundays are impossible for me, she said.
The cottage was beautiful in the heart of the summer. The roof was draped with crimson climbing roses, like the back of the winning Kentucky Derby horse, and the woods beyond were full and lush. Paths between the trees were lined with hostas and jacks in the pulpit. When Tess and Addison had been here the last time, the roses had not yet been in bloom. In a few weeks, Addison had said, we can walk to the water and go for a swim. No one will see us. This cove is completely deserted. I can't wait, Tess had replied. Addison let himself in. He expected the place to be stuffy, but someone, Floribel, the caretaker, had left the windows open, and the breeze moved through the screens, and the white filmy curtains floated like ghosts. They had made love that final time, Addison angrily, Tess apologetically. And when it was over, they lay in uncharacteristic silence. They never spent time in silence. The hallmark of their relationship was that they talked. Addison told her every detail of his day, and she did the same. She knew the status of every one of his deals, and he knew the names and life stories of each of her students. The two of them talked and talked and talked. God, it was a relief, a pleasure to have someone to talk to. At home, Addison could talk and Phoebe would listen, but it was weird. Sometimes she was cogent and understood him and came out with canny responses, but sometimes it was like firing a tennis ball into outer space. And Tess could talk to Greg about the kids or school, but he gave her the distinct impression that he was weary of both topics. She was forbidden from broaching the subjects of money, the house, his job singing at the Begonia, and anything related to the high priorities, like April Peck. So what did that leave, exactly? Discussing the segments of 60 Minutes? It would feel forced. Ditto conversations about books, painting, or sculpture. Tess could talk to Addison about these things, however, and never tire of it. But Addison remembered that lying there, the final day in the cottage, he had struggled with the silence. He had had things to say, oh yes, things that would lead to other things. He had promised himself he wouldn't do it, but he did it anyway, as he knew he would when he made himself the promise. He lay down on the bed. Could he have stopped her from going sailing? Because God knows he'd wanted to stop her. But everything he'd wanted to say was flawed. Nothing was effective enough. He had vetted his thoughts carefully. He had taken a breath to speak, and then shut himself up. I do not want you to go sailing with your husband. He could have shouted it in anger or repeated it 100 times in a whisper stream like a lunatic, but even that would not have conveyed the ardor of his feelings. It was nothing but a parlor game to conjure now what he might have said if he had been brave enough to open his mouth. It wouldn't have mattered what he said, because she was going regardless. Why? Ah, the why. The why was the reason for their silence that final day. It was the reason for Addison's anger and her apology. Why? Not to go would be to send up a bunch of red flags, she said. But this was just her making excuses. She could easily have begged off. She hated the water and always had. She hated to leave the kids overnight. The last year of the marriage, thanks to the heinous event of April Peck, had been a shambles and not worth celebrating. She was in love with someone else. She could have said any of these things, but didn't. She was going sailing, therefore, because she wanted to. She wanted to celebrate the train wreck that had been their 12th year of marriage. She wanted to hear the song Greg had written for her. She wanted to eat and drink and laugh and make love. She wanted to see the man try. Right? Admit it. Addison had not pressed her. He had strictly adhered to the tenet beloved of so many 14-year-old girls. If you love something, set it free. If it was meant to be, it will come back to you. But this, of course, was bullshit. If you loved something and let it go, it would, Hello, find something else to love. It had never occurred to Addison to say, I don't want you to go with Greg because what if something happens? What if you catch a gust the wrong way and the boat capsizes and you get caught underneath and you die? Or what if your husband drugs you and throws you overboard? To which Tess would have said, Oh, Addison, don't be silly. Addison moved to the window, where he could see the trees, the path, the ribbon of inviting blue water. They had made a pact to love each other the same amount, the maximum amount, an unimaginable, overflowing amount. He had loved her that much, but Tess had been misrepresenting herself. I'm afraid you won't get it. The cottage had sold. Another couple would live here, would make love in the bed, would gaze out the window, would shower together or separately, would listen to Mozart or Motley Crue, would cook croquet monsieurs or goat cheese omelets, would sleep soundly or fitfully. And they would never know. Addison took the felt heart, now in three pieces, out of his pants pocket. He scattered the pieces across the bed like sad rose petals. But then, because he couldn't stand to leave them, he shoved them back in his pocket, got up, and walked out the door. Andrea. Her time in the farm attic was coming to an end. The thought was hard to bear. She and Jeffrey had painstakingly detailed 20 of Tess's 35 years on Earth, and Jeffrey had suffered through stories from Tess and Andrea's childhood in South Boston with the police department, the mafia connections, the priests and nuns. Jeffrey had aired out a few stories of his own, stories Andrea had never heard. Jeffrey and Tess had discovered a mangy fox while hiking around Saranac Lake, and Tess had insisted that Jeffrey call a vet to try to save it. Did Andrea know that? No, she didn't, and the story delighted her. They were down to the wire now, though. They had talked circumspectly about the April Peck incident. Andrea had been very tense during this session. She waited for Jeffrey to reveal details she had never heard before. But no, he had been fed the same story as the rest of them. They had talked about the trip to Stowe, their last group trip. This brought them to within 6 months. And it was the last 6 months that troubled Andrea, because for the last 6 months of Tess's life, Tess had been different. She had been distant and unavailable. She had stopped going to Mass with Andrea. She had told Andrea lies. Lies. Andrea had not confronted Tess about the lies, because she had been baffled by them, embarrassed even. If Tess was lying to Andrea, then there must be something wrong with Andrea. Andrea was hesitant to discuss all this with Jeffrey, but maybe he could help her. This process they'd been through together had been painful and rough in places, but ultimately it was working. It was allowing Andrea to keep a tenuous grip on her sanity. So let me ask you, she said. She was, as ever, at Jeffrey's desk, in his chair, overlooking charts and graphs of various crops' growth, piles of invoices to go out to restaurants, and bills. Jeffrey sat on a milk crate a few feet away. Did you notice a change in Tess last winter? He narrowed his eyes. Maybe, he said. She seemed sadder to me, less gullible, less innocent. All of which you can chalk up to a woman who had been through what she had been through with Greg. Every Saturday night, 5 o'clock, rain or shine, we used to go to Mass, right? Right, Jeffrey said. So, at the beginning of February, the start of Lent, she quits church altogether. She cancels on Mass for the first time, saying she has a PTA meeting. At 5 o'clock on Saturday? And there, at the church, I see both Karen and Lizzie, president and vice president of the PTA, and I know there's no meeting. I know she's lied to me. But the thing is that Karen and Lizzie were always at 5 o'clock Mass, and Tess knew it. So why would she hand me that particular story if she knew she was going to get caught? Did you say anything to her? Jeffrey asked. No, I let it go. And then? Then she skipped Ash Wednesday. For the first time in 30 years, she did not go to get her ashes. When I asked her what was up, she said her day had been busy. She had a conference with a parent after school. Then she canceled on Mass the following week, and then the next week she told me she would meet me at St. Mary's, and she never showed. And when I called her, she said her car wouldn't start. "The Kia?" Jeffrey said. "The most reliable car in the history of automotives," Andrea said. And there was other stuff. It was all little stuff, stuff only Andrea would notice. Tess's tone of voice, her attitude. She was at times euphorically happy, and at other times she burst into tears for no reason. She was uneven. But all women were uneven, weren't they? They suffered from PMS, hormonal ups and downs. Tess had had her share of reproductive chaos. Maybe her body chemistry was out of whack. But deep down, Andrea didn't buy it. Tess was not like other women. For starters, she was a kindergarten teacher. She was patient and kind, creative and organized. She loved children, and she believed in the power of paint and crayons and glue and clay and storybooks. She had a class pet, a long-haired rabbit named Knickerbocker. She liked to play kickball and push kids on the swings. She kept a drawer full of snacks and clean underwear and Band-Aids. Her room was always clean. She always wore a skirt or dress. She did not raise her voice. When she wanted quiet, she turned out the lights and held a finger to her lips. She was a saint. To see her moody and peevish, something was wrong. Andrea had asked Ed more than once, "Do you think there's something wrong with Tess?" In response, Ed would shovel in mashed potatoes or grunt from behind the newspaper. If Andrea pressed him for an answer, he would say, "She seems fine to me." Andrea called this a typical male answer, to which Ed said, "When I give you a typical female answer, you can complain." Andrea brayed with disgust, and Ed gave her some line about how women clearly felt things more deeply. They read subtext where men saw only white space. "If you think there's something wrong," Ed said, "why don't you ask her?" Right. Andrea found, however, that she was afraid. Afraid of her own best friend, her own younger cousin, whom she protected and worshipped. It took a night at Delilah's house and 7 glasses of wine for Andrea to confront her. It was Oscar night. Every year, Delilah served champagne and good caviar, and she made beef Wellington, and they all dressed up. Addison always wore a tux, and Phoebe her Valentino or Dior, and the rest of them did what they could. They filled out ballots, threw money into a pot, and the person with the most correct guesses won. This was usually Jeffrey, which was ironic, since he was constitutionally unable to stay awake through an entire movie. Oscar night usually saw them very drunk, and this past year had been no exception. Andrea stumbled across Tess sitting alone on the stairs in her black lace top and black silk pants, and Andrea, with Chardonnay courage, decided that this was the time to confront her. "Is everything okay?" Tess looked up, unsurprised by the question. "Yeah." "No, I mean it. Something's going on. What is it? You haven't been to Mass in weeks." "I'm finished with the Lord." "What does that mean?" "I don't want to talk about it." "Are you mad at me?" This was Andrea's fear, a fear greater, perhaps, than she was willing to admit. Andrea knew she was tough. She knew she was prickly, aggressive, unforgiving. She knew there were women who disliked her, and that even Phoebe and Delilah had their moments with her. But she had always saved her nicest, kindest, sweetest self for Tess. Tess softened. "No, God, no, Andrea. I could never be mad at you." Andrea felt herself about to cry Chardonnay tears. She had been racking her brain, trying to figure out if she had done something wrong, if she had made some kind of egregious misstep that had hurt Tess. "Is it April Peck?" April Peck? Tess looked confused. Then she shook her head, and her chin wobbled. April Peck is such small potatoes. Such small potatoes. The phrase had stuck with Andrea because it was an odd turn of phrase, and because those were the final words on the topic. Addison had come bumbling into the conversation, interrupting them, pulling Tess to her feet, imploring her to come watch. They were about to announce Best Actress. Small potatoes? Jeffrey said now. Andrea looked at him. What do you think that meant? Tess canceled lunch dates. She skipped her monthly book group. She claimed to be taking an intense Pilates class at the gym that met 3 afternoons a week. The Pilates class met from 4 to 5 on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. But one Wednesday, Andrea saw Tess in the ever-reliable Kia barreling down the Pulpus Road at 5 minutes to 5. She was driving like a bat out of hell, which was what caught Andrea's attention in the first place. This may have been a standard complaint from the police chief's wife, but in her opinion, people on this island drove way too fast. Then Andrea saw it was Tess, and she nearly called her, though the last thing Tess should be doing was speeding and talking on the phone. Andrea checked her mental calendar, trying to figure out what would have put Tess on the Pulpus Road at 5 minutes to 5 on a Wednesday. Didn't she have Pilates class? The health club was on the other side of the island. Andrea was the police chief's wife, not the police chief, but she decided to do some investigating herself. The detective work was elementary. Andrea called the health club to inquire about the Pilates class held at 4 o'clock on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. The man who answered the phone was flummoxed. Pilates? We offer Pilates Tuesday and Thursday at 10 a.m. and Monday and Thursday at 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. Nothing on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 4? Spinning class Monday and Wednesday at 3. Jazz dance Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5:30. Do you want jazz dance? Jazz dance? Andrea said. Later, she called Tess at home. Tess was upbeat. I'm making quesadillas, she said. Andrea paused. How was your Pilates class? It was great, Tess said. I can feel it working. My abdomen is so much tighter. Jeffrey was quiet. All Andrea could hear was the sound of the fans, which nicely mimicked the sound his spinning brain might make as it came up with myriad possibilities, then flung them away. Should I state the obvious? He said. She was seeing someone? Andrea said. She was seeing someone. They sat with that a minute, Andrea shocked by the sound of the words. Well, hello, she wasn't an idiot. This possibility had shadowed each of Tess's mood swings, each lie, and particularly the phrases finished with the Lord and small potatoes when used in regard to April Peck. If April Peck was small potatoes, what was big potatoes? Seeing someone? But who? She would have told me, Andrea said. You're right, Jeffrey said. No, she wouldn't have, Andrea said. You're right, Jeffrey said. She thought of me as her mother. She wouldn't have wanted to disappoint you. I wouldn't have been disappointed in her, Andrea said. But even as she said them, the words felt false. Andrea had always had mixed feelings about Greg, but she believed in marriage. She was Catholic. She grew up with a nun living in her basement. When Tess and Greg had separated during that week in November, it was Andrea who had talked her into going back. It was Andrea who had made the picnic for the anniversary sale. She had broken the sacred rule of no gifts because she wanted Tess and Greg to be happy on their anniversary. She had sensed that Tess was getting ready to leave the marriage, and she had been saying, stay. She was seeing someone. Andrea felt the firm clutches of certainty. Tess had been seeing someone. It explained everything. She stood up to leave. She could handle only one revelation per day, and this was a biggie. But was it really as shocking as Andrea was making it out to be? Wasn't it like a pile of dirty laundry in the corner with a blanket thrown over it? Pull back the blanket and there it was, just as you knew it would be all along. Jeffrey stood as well. He was looking at her intently, and she couldn't bear it, because this was goodbye. This was the end of the secret, strange journey the two of them had taken together. Andrea had entrusted her grief to Jeffrey, and he had been tender with it. He had spent hours and hours talking Tessa's life through. It was a painstaking process that no one else would have donated the time to. Andrea had come here because she loved Jeffrey, and Jeffrey let her stay because he loved her, too. Now they had come to the end of the life story of Tess DeRosa McAvoy, and this meant that Andrea would stop coming here. There would be no more stolen hours in the sweltering attic, and this was its own kind of heartbreak. He came closer, and she knew he meant to kiss her. It was okay. He was a matter-of-fact man. She believed in his moral compass, in his sense of right and not right. He took her chin and kissed her with the same deft skill that he did everything else, slip an egg out from underneath a hen, bruise a basil leaf and inhale its scent. He kissed her goodbye, a key turning in a lock. "I don't want you to fret about this," he said. But both of them knew she would. The Chief. The freezer at the juice bar went on the fritz. It was such a sophisticated machine that they needed a team of NASCAR mechanics to fix it, and so Casey had the night free from work. She had volunteered to take the twins out to Tom Neaver's for the carnival, a shabby slice of mainland American life visited upon their beloved island for 10 days. The carnival meant neon lights, rickety rides, rigged games with rinky-dink prizes, and heart-stopping, teeth-rotting fare such as cotton candy, fried dough, corn dogs, and sausage grinders. The twins had been begging to be subjected to the depravity of the carnival for nearly a week. Drew and Barney had apparently already been twice, and the chief was relieved when Casey said she would take them. Andrea could not handle the manic chaos of the carnival, and the chief felt he had put in enough carnival hours with his own kids. He gave Casey $80, told her not to let the twins eat too much sugar, and wished her well. He then called Andrea to see if she wanted to go out to dinner, just the two of them. Somewhere nice. The Straight Wharf? She said no. She was exhausted. From doing what? She was going to take advantage of the peace and quiet by going to bed early. The chief was deflated. He was, if he could just say it, lonely. There had always been the specter of his own grief floating around somewhere, and he acknowledged it now. He, like Andrea, missed Tess, but he also missed Greg. Greg, despite his faults, had been his friend. The friendship had been uneven, sure. The chief was the police chief, and Greg had been a rock star. Morally, they were a lightweight and a heavyweight, a total mismatch, but the chief had loved Greg anyway. If they still lived in the before, and the chief found himself stranded at work without options or obligations, he would have wandered over to the Begonia, taken a seat at the bar, hammed it up with Delilah, ordered a blue burger with extra onions, and listened to Greg play a set. It was, in the chief's opinion, a nearly perfect way to spend an evening. He couldn't handle the Begonia now. No Greg, no Delilah, Faith with her smothering concern, the grating Irish trio on stage. He had a pile of backlogged work on his desk, the result of his preoccupation with the details of the accident, his distracted frame of mind, and the extra hours he had to devote to Andrea and the twins. He should stay and work. He would ask Frida, the evening dispatcher, to pick him up a burger from the Begonia, even though Frida was unfriendly, and especially so when she felt like she was being treated like a secretary or an errand girl. He would have to ask nicely. At 9:30, he was still at his desk, the burger, fries, and double dill pickles demolished. He had eaten 3 Rolaids and was 2/3 of the way through his stack of paperwork. The attendant feeling of relief and accomplishment was keeping his melancholy at bay. He wouldn't even have realized it was as late as 9:30. His office was a concrete bunker without windows, had Dixon not knocked on the door, making the chief look up. Dixon had that goddamn look on his face. "What is it?" the chief asked. "April Peck is here," Dixon said. "She got called in by the bouncer of the Rose and Crown for trying to pass off a fake ID." The chief fell back in his chair.
"Jesus."
"I dealt with her. She said she got it somewhere online, couldn't remember the name of the site. I fined her $300, took the ID, threatened to suspend her real driver's license. She said she wanted to talk to you."
"To me?"
"To you."
"Jesus," the chief said.
"Normally, I would have told her no. Normally, I would have slapped her with a 90-day suspension for trying to go over my head. But then I wondered if maybe you wanted to question her."
"Question her?"
Dixon understood more than the chief wanted him to. The chief's stomach squelched. He'd eaten all that food, and he hadn't moved a muscle. And he was nervous.
"Send her in."
Dixon opened the door and poked his head out into the hallway. "Hey, Dancing Queen," he said. "The chief has agreed to see you." April entered, resplendent in some kind of sparkly black and silver disco dress and silver stiletto heels. Her hair was up. She wore reddish-black lipstick. She looked 25, not 18.
"Miss Peck," the chief said.
"You can call me April," she said. She offered her hand. "I feel like I know you."
"Do you?" the chief said.
"Yes," April said.
She sat demurely, thank God, with her legs angled to the side.
"Greg used to talk about you all the time."
The chief quietly burped up Roquefort and onions.
"Greg?" he said.
"Greg McAvoy."
The name reverberated against the concrete walls of the chief's office. April's face was open. Her eyes were wide and innocent. She did not look like a kid who had just been booked for identity fraud. Was she drunk? She had been steady on the stilettos. Was she a good actress? Or maybe the $300 fine and the fact that she might not be able to drive for the rest of the summer didn't bother her. Who was he kidding? If they took her license, she would drive anyway. "Mr. McAvoy was your singing teacher?" the chief said.
"He was."
The chief looked at April's shining blonde hair and thought of how lost Greg must have been to let her lasso him. Had Greg been in that place men found themselves in when they needed bolstering? His sweet and pretty wife wasn't enough? His 2 healthy kids weren't enough? He needed more. He needed someone to worship him, someone to think he was a hero. "And?"
"And he was my friend."
"Your friend?" the chief said. Nerves jitterbugged across his chest and arms. April Peck should have been just another pretty girl in high school, not so different from the chief's own daughter. But instead, she was a repository of information, answers, the truth. Had Greg and April Peck been having a thing? 1 time, 3 times, every week, every day? Would Greg have a reason to want to drug Tess? The chief understood that knowing the answers wouldn't bring Tess or Greg back. It wouldn't help the kids. But the chief, as an enforcer of the law, wanted the truth. He had to be careful. April Peck had been brought in for trying to pass off a fake ID. She was not here to answer questions about Greg. He could not make her answer. For all the chief knew, April Peck would leave the office saying that the chief had been inappropriate with her. Thinking this, the chief felt the first true wash of sympathy for Greg. April Peck was a suicide bomber. The chief should send her out right now with a 90-day suspension. If Andrea knew April Peck was here, what would she say? April said,
"I know what people think."
What do people think?
They think Greg and I were lovers.
The chief burped again and whispered,
Excuse me.
He had to tread so carefully here. Why would they think that?
She shrugged.
The chief said, I'm a little confused, Miss Peck, about why you wanted to see me. Her face transformed from a placid surface to a stormy one. She was going to cry, and immediately the chief's guard went up. She said,
This has been so hard.
The chief nodded, though barely.
I wanted to talk to you about Greg.
What about him?
He was my friend. I miss him. I loved him. I mean, I really loved him. He listened to me. I have all this stuff going on. Derek, my ex-boyfriend, stalks me. My mother is dying of freaking breast cancer. My dad and brother are in New York, hell-bent on pretending my mother and I don't exist.
She snatched a tissue off the chief's desk and noisily blew her nose.
And really, the only person I could talk to was Greg. He was so nice to me. He was kind. He was the kindest because he could have gotten into so much trouble.
You accused him of sexual misconduct, the chief said. He was nearly fired.
I know. I was confused. I was so completely fucked. I was jealous because it was clear he loved his wife and kids. I was never going to get the best part of him. They were.
So did you lie to the administration? The chief asked. April narrowed her eyes at him as if he were crazy. Crazy to think she lied, or crazy to think she would now tell him the truth? She blotted her eyes.
The amazing thing was that Greg forgave me. After all that, I mean, he forgave me, he listened, he was kind, and then...
And then what? The chief said.
And then he died,
April said. She stood up and paced the back half of the chief's office. You were in love with him? The chief said. April threw up her hands. Was he? Did he say he was in love with you?
I know what you're trying to do,
April said. In the back corner of his office was a filing cabinet, topped with a philodendron and some framed snapshots of Casey and Eric when they were young. April picked up the pictures and studied them. The chief did not like her touching pictures of his family. What am I trying to do? He asked.
You're trying to get me to admit to something, she said.
Admit to what?
See, you're doing it again.
Were you lovers? Was he in love with you? Would Greg have a reason to drug his wife? The chief could ask April these questions, and she could lie or tell him the truth, and he wouldn't know the difference. He cleared his throat. Okay, Miss Peck, it's time for you to go. We are going to issue a 60-day suspension of your driver's license. April whipped around. That's a reduction of the maximum penalty, which is a 90-day suspension, he said. He could have lowered the penalty to 30 days, but he would not do it. And if she gave him lip, he would up it to 90.
You're throwing me out, she said.
I'm not a therapist, the chief said. I am the chief of police. Since you don't have any new or pertinent information about Greg McAvoy or your involvement with him, we have no further business. Should you ever decide there is something else I need to know, you are free to come in any time and talk to me. Understood? April chewed her bottom lip.
Do you know what Greg said about you? Do you know what he told me?
Honestly, Miss Peck, I don't care. She took a deep, resigned breath.
He said you were the greatest guy in all the world.
Andrea. She didn't know what stage she was in anymore. She was in stage limbo. She missed Tess. She missed Greg. She missed Jeffrey. She missed Eddie and her kids. But mostly, she missed herself. She wondered, was she ever coming back? There were certain things she could handle and certain things she could not. She could handle the fact that Tess had had a lover. Andrea was 44 years old enough to realize that the heart wanted what the heart wanted, whether it made sense, whether it was right or wrong. What Andrea could not handle was not knowing who Tess's lover was. She had to find out. She wanted to know him. She wanted to make sure that he had loved Tess enough. Had it been someone at the funeral? Who exactly had attended the funeral? Should Andrea pore over the guest book? Andrea couldn't recall anyone except their immediate group, the children, horrid April Peck and her mother, and Father Dominic. Finished with the Lord. Tess had stopped going to church altogether. Was Tess having an affair with Father Dominic? He was a young man in his late 30s, and he was handsome as far as priests went. She could handle Tess having a lover, but not if it was Father Dominic. She struck his name off her mental list for her own sanity. She thought of other teachers at school, the principal, the superintendent. Flanders? Andrea stopped. Not Flanders. For a brief second, she smiled. Andrea could handle small outings, but not big ones. Ed came home with two tickets to the Island Conservation Benefit, a cocktail party on the Savannah that Phoebe was chairing. "It's on Friday night," he said. "Casey agreed to watch the kids. We're going." "No," Andrea said. "I bought the tickets," he said. "I told Phoebe we'd be there." "No." "She wants our support. The poor woman hasn't done anything since before." "I'm not going, Ed." "She said she has a surprise for us." "Now I'm really not going." He put his hands on her shoulders. This was a gesture that nearly always worked. His face was inches from her face, his hazel eyes, his 5 o'clock shadow. She loved his face, despite the fact that it only ever held one expression, one that conveyed steadfast dedication to the forces of righteousness. It was the proximity of his face that was meant to convey meaning, and the weight of his hands pressing down on her shoulders, telling her that he was present, he would not let her float away, but that he had needs and desires too, and this was one of them. Going to this event for Phoebe was important to him, but she couldn't do it. "You go," she said. "I just can't. I'll stay home." He lifted his hands. "We'll talk about it later." She could not handle a cocktail party, but she could handle a trip to the post office to mail a box to Esmeralda, Tess's adopted Brazilian orphan, who was, all of a sudden, 16 years old. Andrea woke up suddenly in the middle of the night, realizing that she had forgotten all about Esmeralda. Tess still sent her care packages every 3 months. Andrea wrote a letter explaining that Tess had passed away, but that she had cared for Esmeralda very much. She had displayed Esmeralda's photo on her desk at school. Andrea wrote that she, Andrea, would be sending packages now. Along with the letter, Andrea packed brown rice, steel-cut oats, graham crackers, a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird, a new pair of flip-flops, a journal, and a framed picture of Tess. Andrea struggled a bit with Tony at the post office about how to send the box and how to insure it, but they worked it out. All it took was paperwork and money. Tony flipped the box casually into the airmail bin, and Andrea winced, thinking of the graham crackers, but she felt a sense of accomplishment nonetheless. As she turned to leave, she saw a man in line, and her knees buckled. She stopped and stared, and the woman coming up to the counter nudged her out of the way. Andrea stutter-stepped aside, still staring at the man unabashedly. He looked at her and smiled. It was the man from her dream, the Russian, Peter, who had made love to her in her old black Jeep, who had said, "It's your car, you can do what you want in it," who had been drowning until she saved him. It was him, not merely someone who resembled him. Part of Andrea wanted to hurry out and not look back, but she had to know. She said, "Do I know you from somewhere?" The blue eyes narrowed. "Don't think so," he said.
He had an accent. Australian? He stuck out his hand.
I'm Ian Bing. Teach Pilates at the health club. Do you belong to the health club, then?
Andrea blinked. No, she said, I don't. Inside she was fizzing and popping. He taught Pilates at the health club. This was the sign. This was the guy, Tess's lover. Andrea said, but my cousin belonged to the health club, Tess McAvoy. Did you know Tess?
Ian's face was blank. He shook his head, the salt and pepper curls. No, afraid I don't.
Andrea scrutinized him. He looked sincere, but Andrea didn't believe a soul anymore. She checked his ear. No earring. Still, it was him. He had done all those things to her. She blushed. She couldn't help it. And then she said, so you didn't know Tess?
No, he said. Did she take Pilates?
No, Andrea said. Ian smiled at her as if to say, well, as if to say nothing. He did not know Andrea. He did not know Tess. Andrea was making a complete ass of herself. But it was him, Peter, the Russian. Andrea hurried out to the parking lot. Andrea could handle Casey taking care of the twins, but she could not handle Delilah taking care of them. Twice Delilah had called to see if she could take the twins to the carnival with Drew and Barney, and twice Andrea had said no, on the basis that the carnival was a ripoff and the rides were operated by heroin junkies. Casey then took them to the godforsaken thing, and they ate junk and rode the unsafe rides and came home with dirty feet, a stuffed giraffe whose eye fell out during the car ride home, and a pump-action toy gun for Finn, which Tess never would have tolerated. But how could Casey protest when the chief carried a gun? Andrea huffed about the carnival, and Casey said, as only a righteous 16-year-old can, if you don't like the way I'm taking care of them, do it yourself. Delilah had called Casey about the movie. The movie was more than a movie. It was a phenomenon. Wunderkids 3 was premiering on Friday. Delilah had flown all four kids off-island to see Wunderkids and Wunderkids 2 for the big movie house premiere experience the two previous summers, and she wanted to take them again this year. It was now a tradition. So they're going with Delilah, Casey said on Friday morning.
What? Andrea said.